Hello, and welcome back to Millennial. This is the penultimate episode for tonight, and this is with Chris Dangerfield from the Dangerfield channel, which is linked in the description. Now, he is not my usual kind of guest, but I dare say that in real life we would probably get on very well, and I've always wanted to have him on the channel for some time, since I discovered him, really. And Millennial seems like the perfect opportunity. So here we are, and welcome, Chris.
Hey, nice one. It's a real pleasure. I'm really excited about this. It is 9 a.m. here. I'm in Cambodia, and the last time I was awake at 9 a.m., I was awake from the previous night. So I'm in a kind of an odd sort of surreal mode anyway, but this is a real pleasure, real privilege. I watched the last chat, and I look forward to this.
Okay, well, thank you very much. And thank you for going out of your way to be able to do this. It is obviously difficult to coordinate. You pick a time of day that fits most of the guests to do these, but then that it's extremely inconvenient for some other guests. So it's unfortunate, but this is the best we can do. So you wanted to say about how you discovered my channel.
Well, your name had been bandied around various places. I was aware of it before I was aware of the channel. And I think I just clicked on one of the videos in the recommended videos just out of interest to you rather than what that channel was about. And as I started watching it, it turns out that you have an art college background. Yeah, there's the smile I was looking for.
And me too. I thought this would be the thing, right?
Yeah, and it's a strange brew, art school. That, you know, there's, if you went to art school, you know things that other people don't know. And I had a very similar experience to the stuff you was talking about. I went to art school with like a mad passion to meet interesting people, and you know, people I'd read about, the history of literature I'd indulged in. I thought I was gonna, if not be the next Henry Miller, perhaps meet him and things like that. And it was a very different experience. In the end,
you realize that 95% of the people at art college never come to anything because they're not interesting people or talented people. So, you know, it's largely a bunch of fucking wasters.
No, without a doubt, without a doubt. And also, it was a strange time for me because there wasn't YouTube then, and things like feminism, to know about feminism, you pretty much had to go to art school or be a feminist. And I was getting this stuff daily, and I was fighting against it. And I'd get back to my hometown, my working class hometown, Dartford, like North Kent, South East London area, and be moaning about feminism to people who really didn't even think about things like that. And I was getting it daily. And it was
it starts in the colleges and the universities, doesn't it? I mean, that's, you know, I've said before, as far as I can sort of work it out, multiculturalism as a doctrine was sort of decided upon at the teacher training colleges at least 5 years before it was decided on by the government to push it. But in the education sector, they were preparing teachers to push this stuff years before, like maybe 10 yeah. years, I don't know.
I mean, that doesn't surprise me at all. I went to art college. I think I went to four or five in the end, and I ended up studying critical theory at Leeds Uni. Yeah. Steady, come on. Okay, I was a young man.
Oh, I know. I don't blame you. I mean, you know, it was all just the same shit where I went. I don't know if it's safe to say, to name our art colleges. I don't know if it's already out. In fact, I'm not going to name it. I'm not going to make it easier for them. But yeah, it was a London art college that I went to, and well, first I went to one in the north of England, and I don't know, there's not much to say about that. It was a much happier experience, but I didn't really learn anything. And then I went to London. I didn't really learn anything there either. And it was a prestigious art college. That's the thing, and you realise that actually that doesn't mean anything.
No, I mean, I'm aware of the main London art colleges, and as far as I can work out, anyone I know has been there over the last 20 years. The majority of the learning is about how to run your business as an artist, which actually, in terms of the pragmatic reality of being an artist, that's very important. But it seems to be pretty much the dominant part of it now. You know, this is how you run your business. oh, yes, and then think about something at some point. But I came out of 7 years of higher or further education. I can never remember what one it is. A communist. You know, I came out there. My master, look at that grin.
This is so funny. Yeah, I mean, of course he did.
Yeah, it was my master's.
I imagine that the schools must have been really lefty in London, like before they were in the rest of the country, I would imagine.
Well, I went to a state comp and there was no time for politics. It was just hassle. It was ridiculous. There was four of us to a textbook. That you meant school or did you mean art school? You meant school then.
I meant school, like high school.
Yeah, no, I can safely say I didn't get any of that at college. At school, I learned nothing. It was just a joke. It was violent. It was brutal. There was physical punishment, beatings. One of my teachers threatened to kill me, literally grabbed me around the neck and said, next time you fuck me about, I'll forget my job, I'll forget my family, and I'll fucking kill you, Dangerfield. I was 14. and you know when you're at school, you're like, you know, when I'm older, when I finally reach puberty and I see that fucker, I'll bite his throat out. I was about 19 and I was in W.H. Smith's in my hometown and I saw him and I was terrified. I was shaking like a leaf. I'd rather that not be the story. I'd like to tell you I went up to him. I took my shoe off. I put it through his eye socket. No, I just was there reading some magazine. Oh, my God, I wish this wasn't happening. No, the trauma it was potent. But going back to my master's degree, it was a communist boot camp. There was nothing about communism or Marxism in the prospectus. You know, I was looking at going in there. I was really into Derrida. I was really into the French pop postmodernist Jean Baudrillard. You know, and I wanted to read literature. And I went to the interview and I told them that. And they were like, yeah, yeah, yeah. And I went in there and it was just one Marxist after the next turning up.
You will read literature, but it will be all fucking communist literature.
Mm. And I mean, feminist literature and post-colonial theory.
Oh, yeah. You know, I once tried to read a book about post-colonial studies. It was like a handbook for anyone who finds themselves on that degree course. And the fucking stuff was just so awful. I nearly made a video about it in the first year, but for some reason, I don't know. I don't know why I didn't. I remember doing notes for a video about this book, about how insane the text was. You know, you'd get these paragraphs that said as little as possible with as many words as possible. And in the end, it's all about the fact, it's just about power. It's just about, well, these people have power, these people don't. Let's write 2,000 pages about that. And it's just fucking boring. It's like, yeah, okay, some people have power, some people don't. Big fucking deal. Yeah, this is reality. It's not the end of the world. And it's not automatically unjust. It's not automatically inhumane. It's not automatically evil. It's a reality. And, you know, power changes hands and this happens. I find it really quite a boring topic, actually.
It's shocking stuff. I mean, you're exactly right. There's no mention of achievement. There's no mention of success. There's no mention of failure, more interestingly. It's just, oh, this is unjust. This is unfair. These people, you know, the outlook is, and this is a sort of an element of Marxism that has contaminated the entirety of the social sciences. You cannot achieve anything without treading on someone. That's the angle. And that's bullshit.
There's an episode of In Our Time, and I haven't listened to it for years, In Our Time, but there was an episode that I got this archive of all these old episodes, and there was one from, I think, 98 or 99, between two literature academics, and one of them, Harold Bloom, I knew was Jewish, but then the other one also turned out to be Jewish. I'm surprised. Like, years later, I thought, oh, she is as well. Fucking hell. But anyway, they were each, like one of them, right? He was sort of taking a sort of conservative position on Shakespeare. And she was taking the feminist position on Shakespeare. And it's a very interesting, just like 45-minute demonstration of how the obsession with power, which is all they've got, it's really all their only concern with human nature, the human condition, and so on, is power. Who does what to whom? And it's a very interesting demonstration of how that obsession just drowns out everything else and actually sort of saps the joy out of life. Because this woman, all she could do was put Shakespeare on the dock, in the dock, instead of enjoying and in any way benefiting or being enriched by his work.
And that's absolutely key. I mean, for fuck's sake, Shakespeare like dominated literature for centuries. Incredible. And to only get that out of it. I mean, I have a certain amount of resentment. I've tried to accept it and sort of move on. But once you're a communist, once you take on all that bullshit, you're not allowed to enjoy life. And you can't. You just can't. And I spent, 20 years of my adult life terribly unhappy until I let go of that stuff.
I've actually been able to locate the episode, and I've linked it in the live chat. I'd really recommend that people listen to it because it's very, very interesting. And I'll link it to you, Chris, as well, just in case you're curious.
Sure.
I'll maybe put it in the description since it's come up and it's quite a prominent thing here. So I'll maybe put it in the description afterwards. Very good recording from whenever it was. Let's 99 it was. So, but anyway, sorry. There it is for people to listen to. Go ahead. What were you saying that you had resentment for 20 years or so on? What was it based on? I mean, what was it? How did it start? And what was the food? What was the fuel for it?
Well, just that idea that for you to have something, someone else has lost, this kind of ridiculous understanding of balance. And, for me to enjoy my privileged sort of English culture, we must have trodden on Africans or South Americans to have achieved that. And there's this level of sort of guilt that you're just, it's just sort of programmed into.
It's zero sum, but it's not, it's actually on or off. It's like you were either just really bad, and they were really benign, and that's the end of the matter. It actually becomes that caricaturish. Now, obviously, yeah. If you were to say this to a Marxist academic, they would say, "Oh no, I can understand that everything's complicated and all that," but they don't actually act like that. They act as if the white man is just wholly fucking bad. It's a set, because they never talk about the good stuff. They never talk about the fact that we gave can I safely say this? that we benefited Africa in many ways. Let's put it that way. They never talk about that. They never talk about now either, the fact that we give so much foreign aid to them and all the rest of it. Even now, we're still wholly bad. And they've done nothing wrong. And they can only, they're sort of benign teddy bears, which again is dehuman. That's actually dehumanizing for them because they're not. Same with the Muslims. They are people with agency. But the Marxist lefty academic, I really think, sees them as just, it's indulgent on their part. It's really indulgent on their part.
No.
They just see them as pets.
But however, alongside that, I mean, my there was lots of hilarious incidences at my art college that I would like to talk about, because it's mad that while you've got all that sort of propaganda and political indoctrination going on, you've got lots of very damaged young minds being pushed further and further to the edge. My first degree was visual performance, they called it. This was at a college called Dartington and
was this Brett in the Hall. Was this in the early 80s, the late 80s, the 90s?
This is in the early 90s.
Right.
Okay. Early 90s. And these were Bretton Hall and Dartington were considered the last bastions of the sort of English avant-garde art colleges. I mean, I'll give you a few examples of pieces of work that were put on. And, I was doing a lot of acid. I was stoned all the time. I was drunk pretty much every night. And you're having to go to these pieces.
Probably the only way you were able to get through it.
Yeah. Well, you need medicine for that kind of madness. But you'd have to go and see other people's work. That was one of the deals. And it would, it was in the middle of the countryside. There wasn't a lot going on in terms of sites. So it'd always be in the car park or in the dance hall or all these same local situations. And you'd get there and there'd be like a gay man in a bath of ice. And it would just be body popping from the cold. And he'd just be in there torturing himself for 5 minutes. I would be crying my eyes out, hysterical laughter at the absurdity of it. And the mad thing is, they'd take that on board. You could not get in trouble. it was impossible to get in trouble because they'd say, oh, well, you're obviously laughing because you're nervous. And I go, yeah, let's explore that. And you'd say it as a joke. And the teacher would be like, no, but let's explore that. And you're looking back in the face and go, let's work out what's really going on. And they'd be buying this shit. You could. I remember there was this one lecture. There was a big octagonal lecture hall. And one side of it was steps going all the way up. And everyone sat on that. And there was two tutors down in the middle sitting on these chairs. And they were talking about time and space and, the usual culprits and artistic production. And I was talking to my friend and I was just saying to him, this is so dull and boring. I am so bored. And my friend said to me, I'll give him credit. He said, right, let's run down the stairs, run in between the two tutors, get to the back window. I'll slide the window open. You chuck our bags out. I'll jump out. You jump out, shut the windows and we'll fuck off across the grassy bit and we go to the bar. And I was like, all right, yeah. And he went, 3, 2, 1, go. So we've gone down, run between them. Everyone's cracking up, windows open, military operation, get out, sprinting across the field, running backwards so we can see them all laughing and all that. Of course, we go back to the following lecture the next day and it's taken on board, and the tutors are literally like, we want to discuss, what motivates that kind of, what do they call it? A maneuver. What I mean, in a way, it's an artistic maneuver. And you're just sitting there thinking, yeah. But I'm thinking, I've got 3 years of this. This is bliss because this is just endless piss taking.
But of course, it's piss taking, but it's not so satisfying if they're not getting angry about it. But
no.
It's interesting. I'm trying to work out why they do that. Is that part of the sort of programming that they just never get angry, that they're so... And they won't, I mean, I imagine that these will be sort of second or third rate academics who are just acting on suggestions from above, from top tier academics. So it's not like...
No. We had some top, well-written, well-published lecturers.
We didn't in London.
And you know when you haven't got one, don't you? When it's just someone last year's graduate that they've got in because the budget's slipping.
Oh yeah, that happened as well. That's another thing altogether. I'm wondering what the thinking is. Is it just like if we never get angry, then that enables us to sort of melt through everything that they do to us, the resistance.
No, I think it's unfair to say they won't get angry, but anger will be taken on as well. I remember a friend of mine punched one of the tutors. He sort of knocked him down. He laid one on him, and that was taken on. Anger's all right as well, but everything will be put through some kind of analysis rather than...
deconstruction.
There you go. Exactly that. Let's find out what the unconscious overdetermination for this behavior was and et cetera. Listen to this. In my third year, I read Foucault's Discipline and Punish. I'm sure you're aware of Foucault, if not that particular book. And it inspired a piece of work in me. And this piece of work was me and a friend. We had ice hockey helmets on. We had broomsticks with a bit of pipe lagging on them. I mean, it's still a broomstick. The lagging just stops it cutting your skin. Gum shields, other sort of padded sort of, I don't know what it was, maybe skate clothing or motorbike clothing. And we gave a set of rules out on the door. We had someone sitting behind a desk. We had security guards and they had to sign a load of contracts. None of them legally binding, but they would have appeared to that to a 20-year-old idiot undergraduate. It looked official. You had to sign 4 or 5 documents. They were stamped. You were photographed, all this kind of stuff. And then you were given a set of rules. And the rules were you've got to walk in the room, not establish eye contact with anyone. You've got to pigeon step along the black line on the floor and you've got to be out of the room in 1 minute. If anyone broke any of those rules, me and my friend kicked the shit out of them. And we did. It wasn't like a play fight. And, of course, everyone broke the rules. You cannot walk into a room without straight away looking. And when you look up, that's eye contact. And we had tutors come in. We had old lady tutors come in. The librarian, bless her, she was about 70. And I remember taking her kneecaps out and she'd done a full flip. Yeah, it was violent as hell.
This sounds psychopathic.
No, it was insane. It was absolutely insane. And I remember I got a first for this piece of work, by the way. And I remember being with my tutor afterwards. And we were sitting there and he had this look. And I loved this man. He was my mentor and everything. And I still have a lot of respect for him. That gets kind of complicated. Complicated in that context always sounds sexual, doesn't it? And
I know what you mean. But this is amazing because this is really crazy behavior. You know, like being violent towards older people, especially an old woman. But I can understand that the environment sort of, you begin to think, I mean, I remember being that. I was 18, 19, and just thinking, well, nothing really matters. It's just a matter of sort of being as clever than the next person in deconstructing even more.
Yeah, and also the idea that I was going to go out into the world and be an artist, I needed to do something that was going to get attention. This was marketing, you know. We had classes about that sort of stuff. Roles and function of the artist was one of the modules we had to do. But I was with this tutor, and he said to me, "He said the potential for violence was amazing." And I was thinking, "Well, I don't know about potential; it just was violent." And then there was
you did this thing. See, this is what I'm trying to illustrate to the audience, because they will think there will be people thinking that you're a cunt because you did this to adults, to an older woman, and so on. But the fact is that you actually got rewarded for this behavior because they didn't punish you for it.
Mm. Oh, without doubt. And you know, it's weird after what I was just saying, but now I'm going to defend it and say, well, that was what the work was about as well. Discipline and punish. It was all taken into this. And then this idea that she read the rules. I'm not defending it. That's why I'm telling you the story. But at the time, well, she read the rules. She signed the contracts. One second. Come here. You're going out. Well, she won't come on camera. But then there was a big art festival in Cardiff, hard working class Cardiff. And they said to us, it was called Live Art in Time. And they come to my college and they said to my tutors, can you select three of your budding artists to come and put a piece of work on at Cardiff Art in Time? And they asked me, they said, would you exhibit Discipline and Punish at Cardiff Art College? Cardiff Uni. And I was like, it's not just art students and old ladies we're smashing up now. This is like engineering and rugby types. So I got another mate in and I said, right, there's three of us now. We had our ice hockey masks, we had our sticks and all that. Exactly the same, signed the contracts and all. Woes, I was shitting myself. Man, I had a nose ring and dreadlocks. You know, I wasn't a hard case, you know, does it show? and so we're standing in there and it was the same setup. There's a line on the floor. We had a very low lit with the line on the floor lit up with torches, some sort of laser, you know. Oh, the aesthetics are necessarily important when you're hurting people. Security guards, all the contracts and all that. And we ended up having fights with about 30 people. Again, every single one. Word had got out that there was these three communists, basically, from an art college, and they were beating up Cardiff Uni students. So now we had blokes walking into the middle of the room, brick shit houses, standing there going, well, come on then. And it was like, oh, for fuck. And you know, when you have a fight, the adrenaline afterwards is just insane. I mean, I guess for real hard people, it comes before the fight or during it. But for me, it's always after. I'm sort of just a nervous wreck. And after about the third fight, I was nearly in tears. I was thinking, this is ridiculous. This is on top. And like I said, I was just standing in the middle of the room. And some of the fights at that one, it would get to the point where, I mean, we didn't just hold them on the floor and kick the shit out of them. The idea was, hang on. The idea was, this gets better. The idea was to eject them. You know, we weren't just smashing them up until they managed to escape. You know, if they wouldn't leave, that's when we laid in, and that's when. And there was scenes where, as we were throwing them out, they were smashing into the doorway and then doing full tumbles, and three of us fall on with these wooden sticks jabbing them in. There was Clara everywhere. Now we're at about the 30th fight, and the three of us, every in between each one, we're looking at each other and it's like, who's going to break first? Because none of us want a beer anymore. And then my mate, who's one of the security guards, he's looking at your face. one of my security guards, he ran in, he said, listen, He said, listen, one bloke has just screamed at me out there. He's going to get the rugby team. They've had enough of you. You need to get the fuck out. Just as he said it, I've looked behind him because there's a little crack in the door. There's about nine monsters running. They've got baseball bats. They've got copper pipes. God knows. And I'm like, hang on, this is like the Warriors now. I mean, can you dig it? So I said, we got to fucking go. So now we've sprinted the other way and it's fire door. We've opened the fire door. We're on a grit rooftop. We're being chased across the rooftops. They've come out. I can see them. They've come out through the fire door. There's these, me and my two dipshit stoned mates with these stupid ice hockey hats on, which are now kind of on a tilt, like blinding us and obscuring our vision. We've got these ridiculous boots on. Now we're running towards a transit van, and it was literally fucking drive, drive. And my mate, and we jumped in the back of a movie. We ran away from the act. And this is the true spirit of our weakness. When it was actually a real fight and we lost our power, we ran like children. We were in the back of that transit. I remember the three of us on the verge of tears.
Well, that is interesting because, of course, it brings it all home, doesn't it? Like communists are. It is always a form of moral weakness, isn't it? I mean, in the end, it's still scared shitless.
Yeah. No, without a doubt. And, you know, I could give you countless examples of that kind of madness. There was a lot of self-harm in pieces of work. There was this one lad and, you know, we turned up to his piece of work. You know, it's a Friday night. We've all been in the bar and it's like, you had to go to everyone's work.
I just want to say one more thing about that. The fact is that not only were you rewarded for it by not being punished, you were then encouraged in doing it because they asked you to do it at this Cardiff University. So it was like lecturers were actually encouraging this actively.
It was considered one of the best pieces of work that had been at that college for years. It's still talked about. You know, my channel, a lot of my people are ex-students from that college, and they'll tell me that
Are they people that you once beat up?
I'll tell you what, one of the people we
did. Maybe a free time subscribe.
I know where you live. Do you remember String Bean from the TV Day of the Triffids? It might have been a bit before your time.
On a second. I did see it. 1981.
That's it, around that time.
Yeah, I've seen it, yeah.
The lead role in that is a bloke called String Bean. That's his sort of nickname in real life. He was one of the people we kicked the shit out of. He came. Oh, yeah. Oh, I've beat up many a celebrity.
Right, good, good. Please keep doing it.
Listen, let me tell you about this.
I shouldn't say that. That could count as advocating violence. Obviously, I'm joking. I love celebrities, especially modern ones.
I haven't made any artwork or indulged in any violence probably since then. But there was a lot of pieces of work. I mean, there was no looking after the students. The cases of madness at that college, every couple of months someone got sectioned and everyone saw it clear as day building up to it. And of course, when it was brought up in classes, it would be like, well, yeah, but what is madness?
Oh, fuck.
And it would be like that bloke who's nearly killed himself, who's now in a fucking straitjacket. I'd suggest that's pretty close to the line. This one fella, we've gone to see his piece of work and he's got a breeze block, which isn't a thermalite, which people tend to think. It's a very abrasive stone, small stone compressed block. And for 30 minutes, he dragged his knuckles across it. I mean, pushed on it, and you could hear it. And claret everywhere. And we're all just sitting around, yeah. And at the end, an applause, like it was a show.
I've seen it so many times, like, back in the day. Not things like that, but I've seen the reaction. The reaction is always the same. It's always this, pretending, acknowledging that you're confused, but also pretending that you're interested and that you have faith in the work. I'm confused because I'm being enlightened. When really, it's you know at some level, this is fucking meaningless garbage. And it's a complete insult. You sort of dread that it's meaningless. You don't want it to be meaningless because that makes you a complete fool. Yeah. That, you know, so you sort of tell yourself, no, there is something in this. And in the meantime, you're just doing the body language. I've seen it so many times with people back in the day, you know. And people who should know better, and guys in their 40s and 50s who are, you know, bald and all this, and they've been probably there with their polo neck for 20 years watching this kind of shit, and they still haven't realised, I'm a complete fool.
Well, the problem with it is I think there was a place for a lot of that stuff. I think, you know, in all practices, limits need to be transcended, especially creative practices, because I heard you say in the last stream that for you, art isn't political or shouldn't be. And I would perhaps argue with that. I certainly don't think it should dwell in the aesthetic as a priority, you know. And I do think in creative practices that limits should be transcended, but all that stuff, all that endurance stuff, like I've seen people at that same college put themselves into seizures, you know, laying on tables until they were foaming at the mouth and, you know, in real trouble and having to be brought back to life. But that's all been done. It was done in the 70s. It was done in the late 60s.
This is the trouble with transcending limits. Eventually there are no, you know, there are no more limits to transcend. You can't do it because someone else has already done it. So, you know, how do you keep doing it? I mean, and then you've got the question, well, hold on a minute, why are we transcending limits in the first place? I mean, it's one thing to transcend technical limits and material limits and, you know, discover new things. But it doesn't hold the same in the realms that we're talking about here. Sometimes limits are there for a damn good reason. Sometimes it's sanity. And, you know, I would say that this is exactly demonstrated by your experience at art college, that there was, it was insanity because they had transcended all limits. There was nothing left. I mean, even beating up an old woman is, you know, you're transcending limits, right? I remember that I might have said this before in the channel. The BBC has always had this real problem with a genre called the arts magazine programmes. They never know how to do it without it being shit, because there's no way to do it without it. It just always comes across as very try hard, trying to be cool, trendy, but you're trying to talk about something serious, so deep. But there's just the I don't know how you'd say it, that the form obstructs the content over and over again. It's just no way to do an arts magazine program and do it well. And but anyway, one of their last attempts, as far as I know, was called The Culture Show.
Yeah.
And I watched an episode of this. I think it must have been 2005 or 6. And in three times in one episode, different people used the expression pushing the boundaries to justify a work of art. It was three different people talking about three different works of art or three different sort of cultural things. And one of the things was a sort of new urban form of Morris dancing. There you go, right? That's pushing the boundaries. It's pushing the boundaries of what we're used to in urban environments, and it's pushing the boundaries of Morris dancing. So it's a twofer.
Okay, so Woj, you went to two art colleges. I'm guessing you studied for at least 4 years?
Yes, it was 4 years. I did, the first year was at in the north of England, and then I did 3 years of a degree. I dropped out of that degree and started a new one in London. Yeah.
Okay, so what would you say the social role and function of art is?
Oh, fucking hell, now we're going to get serious.
It won't last.
See, even that question, it sort of invites a Marxist response. It's like you say, the social role. And because I don't know, the terminology just puts you in the frame of mind of, you know.
Okay.
But still, if we think about Michelangelo or something, clearly he had a social role, and it's one that transcends his time as well. And it, you know, he's still there, still in society, still a presence, still something. But that role in society doesn't really have much to do with power, which is the thing. Right. When you say what is the social role of the artist, that implies, okay, the artist is there to in some way interfere with the power dynamics in society at that time. That's the thinking that you're put into by that terminology. But I don't think that the role of the artist necessarily has anything to do with that. I think the role of art is to transmit ideas in a way that, in some way, that maybe can't be done any other way. It's to transmit them in such a way that they are not necessarily accepted or rejected. And it's to also celebrate beauty, both in form and aesthetics. And it should also be something that is rooted in a culture, a heritage, an identity, a people, because otherwise I think it's probably probably meaningless without that.
Can you make something that is not rooted in a culture and a heritage?
Yes.
Really?
Probably, but I don't think it would have much meaning, and therefore I don't think it would have much function.
But I'd wonder where that would come from.
Well, yeah. I mean, how could you do it without... Because you'd have to be a human being to do it, to create this thing, and your culture is always going to be trying to interfere with... Because, you know, you don't come from nowhere. So
exactly.
I don't know if you could do it at all. But assuming you could, I don't think the result would even be, you know, have any worth. I don't think it would work.
I mean, the problem I have with the problem I have with the beauty idea is that's going to be entirely subjective anyway. And I'm not in any way surprised that you'd bring up something like Michelangelo. You know, this is where people go to. This is where the people went to when I was growing up, when they were telling me that Picasso was just bullshit and he was taking the piss out of everyone.
Well, it's like the same reason that you get to Shakespeare when you talk about literature, because if we talk about modern literature or modern art, we don't know if we're on safe ground at all, whereas at least we can sort of rest assured, okay, I know that Shakespeare's good, to say the least. I know that Michelangelo is good, to say the least.
But they're good... They're good with a certain agenda. They're good at certain things, but you know, there's modern literature that has done things that Shakespeare could not have done because the time he was in. Someone like Kurt Vonnegut, you know, he's achieved things that Shakespeare couldn't even dream of, and only because of the context.
Operating in a completely different cultural milieu, and yeah, historical context. So yeah, Shakespeare is going to be stuck in the late 16th century, early 17th century. I think he died in 1612 or something. Anyway, whatever. He's going to be stuck in that time. But the point is, I know what defenders of him would say. They would say that it doesn't matter that he's stuck in that time because the human condition is still basically the same as it was then. And, you know, whatever Kurt Vonnegut says about isolation, madness, dehumanization, Shakespeare has probably addressed it in one or more of his characters.
Well, certainly, there's only a handful of stories really told in different contexts, but what Shakespeare couldn't do that someone like Vonnegut could do was talk about things like Dresden. Just
yeah,
couldn't do
of
it.
Of course, yeah.
So yeah. It's easy to say that Shakespeare is amazing and superb, but when it comes to responding to Dresden, he's terrible.
Yeah, but you can apply what he said about, you know, what he showed about human beings to Dresden. I mean, if we're going to talk about hate, for example, or mindless destruction, I know that there are characters like, Iago in Othello, who is just, for example. I mean, I will confess, I'm not going to pretend to be any kind of expert on Shakespeare. Because I'm
likewise.
Not, and I wish I were. I wish that my whole high school experience had just been one Shakespeare play after another, because it was the only thing
Macbeth.
I really value. Macbeth, I got Macbeth, we got Romeo and Juliet and The Merchant of Venice. That was the first one that we did. I think Macbeth, I really like Macbeth and Romeo and Juliet.
Yeah. Absolutely fantastic. Check out this, at my state comp, we watched the film before we read it because they knew we would not have been able to make head nor tail, and they did not have the time or the skills to teach us.
Oh, of course.
And I knew it. I knew it as a kid.
Was this Macbeth you're talking about?
Yeah.
Was it the Polanski version of Macbeth?
Yeah.
It's really good.
No, it's fantastic. I'm not knocking that at all. However, when you're meant to be teaching kids literature, perhaps teach them literature.
Yeah, you teach them the text first, and then you allow them to see the thing playing out in real time. Of course, that was how we did it. But I do remember that the version of Macbeth we watched at the end was the Macbeth one. The Polanski one. Now, I'm not defending Roman Polanski, but the fact, and I've even made a video about this very matter, it's a sort of annoying that he is a fucking talented director. I mean, I've seen Chinatown as well and several others. But his version of Macbeth's great. It was extremely atmospheric and sort of gritty. There was a sort of roughness about the image, which was it suited the material very well. And I liked it. I liked it a lot. That was how it was taught.
It's funny, actually, that you were saying then about you're not defending Polanski and for obvious reasons. But interesting with literature, how people talk about authors. I was talking with Hugh. It was lovely, actually. We were pissed out of our brains in a little bar in Vietnam the other week. And we were talking about it, and it's like, what authors do you like rather than what books do you like? And that kind of happens a lot, doesn't it? And it doesn't really stand up to pretty much, it doesn't stand up to any analysis. And why would you group someone's works together under the name of the author? That's another very long conversation and probably not great.
Well, we're coming up in 40 minutes. Yeah. I mean, there are different ways to group things together. You can group them by topic. You see, that's another one of these things where it actually doesn't matter. You know, but the communists will make it matter somehow. It's like, well, you're exhibiting power over the source.
You know what? As I was saying it, I was thinking again, I think it's Foucault's essay, Death of the Author. And I thought, this little wry smile you keep giving to pretty much everything I say is you identifying the remaining traces of Marxism on all my thoughts.
Yeah, I'm sorry. But it's because I recognize it. I can feel, okay, that's deconstruction, that's deconstruction, that's it is there. I mean, it's a thing because, once you've been through that precious experience of art college, you always remember that it's just constant acid. It's like, well, in your case, it's constant acid of another type as well, perhaps. But I mean, cultural acid and intellectual acid, they're just constantly breaking stuff down.
I am somewhat playing devil's advocate with a lot of that stuff, though. You know, I do it a lot because it improves my... Look at you laughing, not buying that for a minute. Fuck you.
No, I'm not. No, don't worry about that. It's keep going. I'll be honest. I don't read much at all because I don't have time. And it's another thing. It's another way in which my lifestyle is unhealthy, dreadfully unhealthy. It embarrasses me a lot, actually, that I just don't have the reading that people expect me to have. But it's a problem.
I think literature is fetishized to an extent. I think as long as you're taking in information and you're taking it in with a certain amount of critical distance and you're thinking about it, books are fetishized. You know, it's a lump of wood, really, isn't it? I mean, if you were taking in no information, and I don't get that impression from you at all, then there'd probably be an issue. But you know, books.
Yeah, there's
better technology. You know, I had over 1,000 books from my 7 years at higher education. I had pretty much everything Derrida had ever published in English. I had everything Foucault published. I had everything Freud published. I had tons of American contemporary American literature, all Henry Miller, all that lot. And I gave it all away. People were like, I can't believe you've done that. But it was like, I used to have to carry 10 big wooden crates every time I moved. And spending 20 years on heroin, you tend to move quite a lot because you're never paying rent. And so it was just a nightmare. And the answer was, there's better technology. I've now got a Kindle. It's got like 5,000 books on it. It's this big. It doesn't collect dust and it doesn't break my back every time I get chucked out of a house, which incidentally doesn't happen anymore. I live in a lovely place in Phnom Penh. But nonetheless, if I had my books here, there'd be a fuck other beasts that try and kill me on a daily basis here.
Right. Well, yeah, I mean, I'm the same with my CD collection from back in the day. I remember when I got an MP3, I got an MP3 player and converted them all. And it was amazing because I no longer had to cart these fucking CDs around everywhere. But I
exactly.
There's obviously a lot that we could talk about, and maybe we should do that because it's very entertaining. It's very interesting, actually.
I was desperate to rekindle some art school trauma in you because that's what I saw in that video. It was apparent behind the dead eyes of your memories.
I did two videos in the first year. Should you go to art college? And what was it called? The contemporary artist or something. I can't remember what it was called.
That's the one I saw.
Right. Has my... No, that's fine.
Maybe one day we should do that. We should have a chat about art school. We could do a contemporary art evaluation, have a look at some of the stuff being made. Oh my God.
Yeah. Oh my God. I can't even imagine what it's like now. I mean, the ones who were students with me will now be lecturers, unbelievably.
Yeah. Yep. Terrifying.
Fucking hell. Anyway. Let's call it a day here because I think it's been a very entertaining stream, and I think we actually have covered a topic quite nicely. So let's leave it before it starts to fall apart and we get repetitive and so on.
Well, you broke up then, but I caught the end of it, and I no doubt I agreed with everything you said.
Okay, all right, great. Okay then. Well, this is really enjoyable for me anyway. I hope it was for you at home as well. Yeah, and excellent. This is Chris Dangerfield. Thank you very much for appearing on Millennial. I'm glad that we did this.
It's been a real pleasure. Thank you.
Okay. And I'll be back in about 45 minutes with the final one, who is John Mark, and that'll certainly be very different from this one. So, he's a new character on the scene. And, I'll look forward to that. So, thank you, Chris, and I'll see you all later.